the studios of KPCW in Park City. This is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
And Scott Greenberg, my new co-host for Cool Science Radio. It's your first week, and welcome to the show. We're really excited to have you.
I'm excited to really be here. This is awesome. I mean, you know, here I am.
Yeah, talking Cool Science Radio. So you have a background in some radio and podcasts. Can you give us a quick overview?
Yeah, very quick. I had a radio show for 12 and a half years in Washington, D.C. on a very popular radio station there, and then for the last 7 years, I've done a podcast called The Vine Guy, very wine-centric-y, but my real passion lies with science. I have an undergraduate and graduate degrees in science, so it's a passion I've been dying to follow, and here I am. I can't believe it. You know, this is wonderful.
Well, we're really excited and lucky to have you. As much as we will miss Katie Mullally on the show, we are excited about having you, Scott. So here we go. Let's launch into this morning. We speak first with Lee Billings. He's the senior science editor for Scientific American, who joins to talk about the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in northern Chile that has recently released its first images of the entire southern sky.
Yeah, and then it's the science of depopulation with economic demographer Dean Spears. Dean is going to talk about global population and, you know, when it will peak, then begin to decline in the next 50 years, and how depopulation's effect can be detrimental.
It's a really interesting and a little confusing concept for us, but stay tuned. It's really, it'll be a fascinating conversation. We'll be right back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
The biggest news in space observation comes from the Vera C. Rubin Space Observatory. It's a cutting-edge astronomical observatory in northern Chile, designed to conduct a decade-long project to map the entire southern sky in unprecedented detail.
Our next guest is Lee Billings, senior space editor at Scientific American, who joins us to talk about the early triumphs of the Rubin Observatory, highlighting how its 3.2 gigapixel camera and rapid wide-field imaging capabilities have already produced many light-first images.
The Vera Rubin offers a resource that could fundamentally reshape both scientific research and public engagement in space science. Lee Billings, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here to be talking about this fabulous telescope. A lot of astronomers have been waiting a very long time for this, and they're very excited about it. And I hope that we can communicate some of that excitement to everyone else.
Well, I'm sure you can. Let's start here. So they've been working on the Vera C. Rubin Observatory for about three decades and, you know, recently launched. We're just now seeing some of the first images in the last, I don't know, couple of weeks or so. Then there are these two confusing acronyms, LSST and LSST. Can you explain?
So that's a really good question. And one reason why it's a very good question is because by answering it, we can kind of get over a little bit of confusion. Because so you mentioned there's this legacy survey of space and time. You could call that LSST for short. That is the 10-year survey of the whole southern sky they're going to be doing. But originally, like you said, this whole telescope, not the survey, the whole telescope was called the LSST. And I believe it stood for Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. And then they decided to change that name to Vera C. Rubin. She's one of the co-discoverers of the first hard evidence of dark matter, which the telescope will be looking at and studying. And so there's been this kind of confusing name game going on where, you know, you have two different acronyms for LSST. What does LSST mean? What is the Rubin? So just again, to be clear, when Rubin started out, when the Vera C. Rubin Observatory started out three decades ago, it was being called LSST, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. They changed the name to Vera C. Rubin Observatory, but it still is doing this survey, the legacy survey of space and time, LSST. on the sky. So I'm not sure if that has cleared things up, but that's kind of how we got here.
Well, we're clear now. So what's interesting to me is if you look up a photo of the observatory, you will see, you know, this is in northern Chile where it is so dry and it's high, almost 9,000 feet. But there are a couple of other observatories, the Gemini South Observatory and the Southern Astrophysical Research Telescope that are also perched atop these other little peaks. Have you been there by any chance?
So I've been to a nearby peak on assignment. I haven't actually been to Cerro Pachón proper, but there's a peak nearby that I've been to for other telescopes. Yeah, the seeing is good. I mean, you could probably hear almost my my air quotes there. The seeing, that's what astronomers call the quality of the atmosphere above. That is the layer of air that's kind of blocking out some starlight that they want to see, right? And so the clearer the skies, the clearer the air, the better the seeing. They're in a place called the Atacama Desert. It is one of the driest, highest places in the world. There's very little water vapor in the atmosphere overhead, which is important for two reasons. That water vapor blocks a lot of near-infrared light, which some of which telescopes, or Vera C. Rubin in particular, can see. So if you have too much water vapor up there, that light won't get through. Also, water vapor is kind of correlated to this thing we call weather down here. You have lots of winds and clouds and rain, all that stuff, all the things that are the banes of astronomers trying to look at a starlight. So way up there, there's not much water vapor. You have these pristine skies, not a lot of rainy, cloudy nights, and there's not much turbulence from winds and things like that. So altogether, it's one of the best places in the world to do astronomical observations. And fortunately, the Chilean government has been very receptive to the United States and other nations building large telescopes there.
Lee, I have to say that, speaking of building, this building is spectacular. It is beautiful. It looks like something Ian Pei probably would have designed architecturally. I know the pictures it's taking of our universe and beyond are spectacular, but how did this project come about? I mean, it's just a phenomenal project to begin with. I'm just curious.
I feel like I would be somewhat, I have to admit, I don't want to talk out of my league here. There have been several different funding sources, and I think first and foremost we have to acknowledge the Department of Energy and especially the National Science Foundation, which are the two federal agencies that are providing the bulk of the funding. However, I remember when I was a Cub reporter, you know, about 20 years ago, writing about this guy, Charles Simonyi, who funded, I think, a big chunk, if not all, of the giant digital camera, the 3.5 gigapixel or whatever it is camera that is capturing these images. And Charles Simonyi, of course, made his fortune with Microsoft. I think some people associate him with Clippy and other parts of us. And he gave a bunch of that money to this project, that when it was called LSST, before doing things like, you know, going to space, things like that. That's another thing he did. Again, I feel kind of bad not having a full authoritative list here of everyone who's contributed, but I think those are three names, the DOE, the NSF, and Charles Simonyi, that all are worth mentioning in this regard. And the core idea behind LSST, back as it was called back in the day, let's just call it Vera C. Rubin now, was that you could, by mapping the whole sky, by looking up at the whole sky and getting a wide field panoramic high resolution view of it, you'd be able to see certain telltale traces of dark matter out there. Dark matter. What is dark matter? Well, it's this thing that doesn't emit light. So how the heck do you see it? How the heck do you study it? You have to use indirect methods. And one of the most powerful methods that we have actually relies on a principle from Einstein's general relativity, which is that mass, big concentrations of mass, bend space. And so what that means is if you have a big hulking cloud of dark matter somewhere out there and starlight shines through it, it will actually magnify and warp and amplify that starlight. It's what we call gravitational lensing. So if you look at the whole sky all at once, and you look at how things change over time, you actually can pick out these gravitational lensing spots pretty well. And by mapping all of them, you can get a better idea of the cosmic distribution of dark matter, and therefore maybe better understand what it actually is. So that was one of the things that was the genesis, one of the core ideas behind this telescope. But as we've seen, as I'm sure we'll talk about really soon, it can do a whole lot more science as well.
Well, if, you know, I don't know what a 3.2 gigapixel camera actually is or does, but I understand that it produces about 20 terabytes per night of data, which is mind-boggling to me. So who is actually interpreting this data and who gets to participate in these studies?
Well, I think the easiest way to talk about that little tidbit, the 20 terabytes of data every night and who's interpreting it, the answer is, you're familiar with HAL 9000 from 2001, A Space Odyssey, the computer that ran the spaceship? It's kind of the same kind of thing here, where that is too much data. That is too big of a data fire hose for any human to drink from unfiltered. You know, your brain would just get blasted to smithereens. So this is obviously the first pass, and probably the second pass too, is going to be done entirely automatically by computers, by software. And then what happens from there is they have there's this automated system to kind of process this data, try to pick out interesting things. The way that happens, long story short, is it gets first what's kind of known as like a static image. You could imagine you look up at the sky, you see the so-called fixed stars that are very far away. They don't move. Right? Maybe they flicker a little bit, maybe they twinkle, but they don't move. You can get that static image of these things that don't seem to change on the sky. And then you keep comparing night after night, image after image, anything that changes from that static image. Any sort of change that these automated systems will detect in those 20 terabytes of data every night and all the images will trigger an alert, a little ping that'll go out to anyone who signs up for it. So this could be professional astronomers. This could even be you. You know, if you have some kind of burning interest in near Earth asteroids, well, you can sign up for alerts, real time alerts that will be triggered automatically by these systems from the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, and you'll get a notice every single time that something in that fits those categories that you've set comes up. Now. This sounds all very smooth and easy, somewhat, but we keep talking about these big numbers, 20 terabytes of data every night, 3.5 gigapixel camera. It's probably going to be sending out on the order of 10 million real-time alerts every night. So even that is just mind-boggling. Even that is something that you can't as an individual process or deal with. So this is kind of getting into a larger part of the story, not of just of Rubin, the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, but also of astronomy itself, which is that we are truly entering this era of big data. And one of the biggest challenges isn't just like, well, how do you find dark matter? How do you study dark matter? It's how do you deal with all this data?
Yeah, that is such a good question. And by the way, I read something that, you know, all these large numbers that we can't even fathom of, we need to compare them to something that we can relate to. So the best thing, the 20 terabytes of data per day is the equivalent of 3 years of streaming Netflix in its entirety.
Wow.
How about that? So that that's a lot of data. I like that one. I can relate to that. I speak Netflix, in other words.
Here's another good one real quick is that each image from Vera C. Rubin is in full detail, at full resolution, if you wanted to print it out and display it, would be about the size of a basketball court. So, you know, some people love to stream Netflix. Some people like to watch basketball. Imagine a basketball court and it's all one image of the sky and you're getting a lot of those every night.
It is just so wild. Okay. So what are the most exciting things that the average person, you know, not just people like you, Lee, or, you know, people who love astronomy are viewing now? I read something about like 2,000 new possible asteroids were identified or have been identified in recent weeks.
Yep. And that's another one where this one even surprised me. If you look at the numbers, the projections, the ballpark figures that people have estimated for the discovery rate of these things, it's there in the numbers, what I'm about to say, but to actually have it before you, to see it actually happening is something else entirely. And in this case, the more than 2,000 asteroids that were found. So it wasn't just in the past few weeks. What it was is that the observatory, they were taking their so-called first science images, right? They're getting their pretty images together to show to the public to kind of give an example of what Rubin can do. They did that across a few nights of observing. But in total, it was only about 10 hours of looking at the sky. 10 hours of looking at the sky. And in that time, that 10 hours, they found more than 2,000 asteroids. That's incredible. I don't even know how long it would take to find 2,000 asteroids in a different scenario and under quote unquote normal circumstances. But of course, Rubin is the new normal. And I do think that this is actually one of the most interesting and publicly compelling applications of Rubin. It's almost a sideshow, if you imagine it that way, to what the scientific objectives were that really fueled the project from the start. We mentioned things like dark matter, studying dark energy, the mysterious force that is driving the accelerating expansion of the universe is another one. Of course, however, we didn't know about dark matter, I don't think, when Rubin was first thought of. I may have the timing slightly wrong on that. Even if we did know about it back then, it was a very, very new idea. Dark energy only really traces to 1998 was when it was really discovered. So we have these things, dark matter, dark energy. They're invisible, mysterious, hard to understand. We don't fully explain, we don't really know what they are. Those things are cool, but something like asteroids, everyone can understand what an asteroid is. Everyone knows what an asteroid is. And everyone knows that every now and then one will wallop the planet in a way that is problematic for all the things that live here, right? Look at the dinosaurs six million years ago. They had a really bad day. So Rubin is going to be able to discover all these asteroids just almost as a side project, as a sideshow of all these other studies it's doing, taking constant pictures of the sky. And that's phenomenal, because it's not only going to tell us, is there an asteroid out there with your name on it that might hit the Earth? That's bad. That's something that it'll do. It'll also tell us other things by looking at the patterns that exist in the orbits, the orbital characteristics of the asteroids. It will be able to reveal different populations of asteroids, different chapters in the solar system's history. All these asteroids have been twirling around the sun for hundreds of millions or billions of years, and orbits don't really change on their own. They change due to external forces acting upon them. They normally stay as they are. So when you see an orbit, or you're able to characterize an orbit of these different objects and study them as populations, you're able to get a better idea of things that happened in the solar system in the distant past, or things that might happen in the future. One thing that people are looking at very carefully is not just near-Earth asteroids, but also objects that are farther out in the solar system, small bodies that are farther out in the solar system. Sometimes we call them comets. These little ice balls, these dirty snowballs that exist at the outskirts of the solar system, way past the orbit of Neptune or even Pluto. There are curious patterns in some of those that we see. I think the details are a little beyond this particular conversation, but the point is that looking at those patterns, those distributions of those old icy objects way out there, some astronomers have gotten this idea that Planet Nine might exist, a new, large, undiscovered world drifting way out there in the hinterlands of the solar system. And the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, by virtue of its all-seeing eye, may find Planet Nine directly. It could, in principle, find some little dot flitting around out there. And then, lo and behold, turns out that's Planet Nine. We just haven't seen it till now because it's so far away and so faint, despite being a relatively large planet. Or more likely, it will be able to look at these clusters of objects, these comets out there, and kind of reverse engineer based on looking at their orbits. There's something out there nudging those things around, and it has to be this big honking planet, right? So people who are interested in Planet Nine are very interested in what Rubin's going to do in that domain.
Oh, wow. That's a whole lot of information. And if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Lee Billings. He's the senior space editor at Scientific American. We're talking about the Vera C. Rubin Space Observatory. Okay, so the telescope is actually about 25 feet wide. It's the largest telescope, largest camera.
Largest camera. There are telescopes on the ground with bigger mirrors. There are telescopes with 10-meter mirrors. There's actually a telescope being built by Europe right now called the European Extremely Large Telescope that's on another peak in the Chilean Andes. And that one is going to have on the order of like a 30-meter primary mirror. It's going to be made up of segments. So there are things with bigger mirrors, but it does have the biggest camera. Vera C. Rubin does have the biggest camera. And I think more importantly, it's not just about the size of the camera. It's about how you use it. And it's about the way that this light gathering mirror looks at the sky. And the big difference for Rubin versus many other telescopes is it has a different figure, you might call it. It has been polished so that its field of view is more panoramic. It's like a panoramic lens. Have you ever seen a movie like Lawrence of Arabia back in the day? It was shot with a panoramic aspect ratio, and it gave you this feeling that you were there in the desert with Lawrence and the Bedouins and so on and so forth. And that's kind of what Vera C. Rubin's going to do for the sky. It has a very wide field of view so that each picture, as we've already mentioned, covers a lot of sky. About 45 times the size of the full moon is how big one picture is. And by virtue of taking those pictures over and over and over again across different parts of the sky, you're going to be able to cover the entire sky every 3 days or so.
I have a quick question for you because I'm really curious. Given your exploration of solitude and the cosmic perspectives in your book, I believe it's 5 billion years of solitude, what does an observatory like the Vera C. Rubin say about our place in the universe?
I mean, wow. Wow, that's a softball, Scott. I don't know. I don't know if I can take that one. Thank you. Thank you for mentioning the book, which of course is now more than 10 years in the rear view, but I'll take it. I'll take it. I really think what Rubin shows, what the Vera C. Rubin Observatory shows, as you can tell, I'm still tempted to just call it Rubin for short, but I appreciate the full name. I think it shows that when we put our minds to it, when we have sustained support for something, we can do it. We can do these amazing things that seem almost impossible on paper. And that's something that seems in many domains, in many dimensions, somewhat unique to our species, right? I mean, there's lots of amazing things and miracles that life pulls off on Earth all the time. Photosynthesis in a leaf, if you ever look into it, is just mind-blowing. It's crazy. We can't do that. The plants can. They do it naturally. They've been doing it for hundreds of millions of years. But, you know, in terms of building big machines to find out our whole place in this big shebang, seems like we've kind of got the lock on that as humans. And I think that the other kind of darker side, you know, the book you mentioned is not just about the search for Earth-like planets. That's what it was about. It's also about how that search was stifled by entirely mundane things, whether it's like, you know, budgetary politics or internecine conflicts between astronomers. We are seeing that same kind of thing unfold maybe with Rubin. We have the telescope built. It's there on the mountain. It's working. And yet, if you look at current budget proposals that are floating around Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., those budgetary proposals, a lot of them are talking about slashing funding for the National Science Foundation. And where would those slashes take place? Where would they affect? It would affect facilities like this. So we are in a bit of a pickle. We need to sustain this further. We need to keep going with this momentum we've built up and not abandon it, I would say. And I think that what it really says about us, about our cosmic moment here, is that it's a choice that we have. Collectively as a species, it's a choice we have that we need to make. And I hope we make the right one.
So do I. I hope we make the right one as well. And I hope the funding keeps going because I think this is important research. It's, you know, are we alone in the universe? Are we not alone in the universe? Maybe Vera will help us figure that out.
I think so. And you know, there, not to be too much of a downer, but one other thing to remember that while we're talking about the prospects for this amazing machine, it's not just a problem of money. There are also problems with how our planet is changing and how it has changed in the time that this thing has been gestating, been cooking in the oven. I think the biggest thing to mention is the rise of what some people call mega constellations. These are hundreds of constellation strong networks, or I'm sorry, satellite networks. One example would be SpaceX's Starlink network. This is more than 7,000 satellites that are passing overhead all the time in low Earth orbit to give broadband, high speed internet access anywhere in the world. Those things, because they're flying over any part of the planet so often, they tend to photobomb astronomers' observations a lot. And the bigger your field of view, the more problematic it becomes because the more of these you're going to see. Now, for something like Rubin, which is built all around the changing sky, seeing changes in the sky, when you have all these satellites passing overhead, that can be a problem for the science you're trying to pull out of those images. It's not an insurmountable problem, but it's absolutely an inconvenience, and it absolutely affects the bottom line of the science and how efficiently you're able to get from point A to B, from raw observation to actual data and knowledge about the universe. So hopefully there's going to be some sort of solution we'll figure out, whether that's making these satellites dimmer and they don't reflect as much light, whether it's maybe turning off their transponders or some of their transmissions when they're flying overhead. I'm not really sure. That's above my pay grade, but it is something that we need to work out, because the problem's only probably going to keep getting worse as more and more of these things launch.
Wow. Hey, I wanted to ask you, Lee, if you could distinguish for us. So we have telescopes in observatories on physical places on Earth, like at Cerro Pachón in Chile, where the Vera Rubin is. But we also have James Webb Space Telescope, for example. So what's the difference? I mean, obviously we've got a much bigger camera that we can get have here on Earth, on ground. But could you just kind of help our listeners understand what the differences are?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lynn. The way I like to look at it is something like Rubin on the ground. You can, first of all, you can hike up a mountain. You can change equipment. You can update it. You can service it. That's way different than having to ride a rocket into low Earth orbit or even further out to where the James Webb Space Telescope is, for instance. That's at a point called the Earth-Sun L2, which is basically where the gravitational fields of the Earth and the Sun and the Moon all come together to make a point of a quasi-stable point where a spacecraft can kind of hang out and not spend a lot of fuel and station keeping. And that's 1.5 million kilometers or 1 million miles further out beyond the moon. So that would, if you know, to get there, that's further than any human's ever gone in space before. It's hard to service things out there. And so you can build bigger on the ground, you can service more easily on the ground, and you can do great survey work on the ground. Something like Webb, on the other hand, can see much, much, much deeper into the universe than Rubin can. With Webb, folks are talking about looking for the first stars and galaxies that lit up after the Big Bang. They're talking about mapping weather patterns on exoplanets around nearby stars. They're doing things like that. And that requires being able to see very, very, very faint things in the sky at very high resolution. Because Rubin is underneath this ocean of air, like other ground-based observatories, it's not, a lot of that stuff really isn't in the cards. You're just not going to be able to get that level of fidelity, that level of performance. And so what we're really looking at here is a situation where something like Rubin will maybe look out in the sky, see some unexplained things or a lot of unexplained things, a lot of ripe, juicy targets, low-hanging fruit for astronomers. And then the things that are most tantalizing, that are coolest, and that are uniquely suited for these more capable and sensitive space observatories will be followed up on with those facilities. So it's like Rubin is kind of the target finder, and then something like James Webb Space Telescope will be following up and doing the in-depth characterization.
Well, Lee, before we let you go, one final question. What about the Vera C. Rubin excites you personally the most?
Ooh, I have two kids and they're always asking, oh, which one's the best at XYZ? And I have to say, I love you both in all your different ways equally. It's kind of the same with what Rubin does out of its whole smorgasbord, its menu of science. I have to say, kind of in keeping with that, maybe this is too much of a platitude, but in keeping with that idea, the thing that I'm most excited about is the LSST, the Legacy Survey of Space and Time, and what it represents. The idea that it is this high definition, 10-year-long time-lapse movie of the sky. What that means is that at the end of this, it'll take a lot of work, but at the end of this, you probably will basically have some kind of short, hyper-compressed version of that that you can upload to YouTube, for instance, if YouTube's still around in 10 years, I don't know, and you'll be able to see it and experience it. Maybe fly through the nearby universe on that time scale with all that in that data set. It'll be this fabulous, amazing data set, and you're going to be able to see all kinds of wild effects within it, many of which we haven't even dreamed. I think really what I'm trying to say, outside of just the pure spectacle of it, the fact that you could have that. I'm most excited for the discoveries that Vera C. Rubin Observatory will undoubtedly make that we can't predict yet, that we don't know about. The trend in astronomy is every single time you have a large new capability go on sky, you find new things. And in many respects, in many quantitative measures, we've never had something that's this big of a step change in astronomy in terms of how much new data it's going to get, how more wide-eyed we're going to be able to see the universe. So I think that in that, there's a lot of promise, a lot of potential. There's a lot of things that we can't even imagine that are going to come out of this that we're going to discover.
Oh, that's so exciting. And you make it really exciting. Lee Billings is Senior Space Editor at Scientific American. Lee, thank you so much for joining us again on Cool Science Radio. Always great to see you and have you here.
It's my pleasure, Lynn and Scott. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
On Cool Science Radio, we explore the science that makes our world tick. And today we look at the science of depopulation. The year 2012 was likely the year with the most births in human history, 146 million. Each year since, that number has declined. According to our next guest, economic demographer Dean Spears, who's also a development economist and associate professor of economics at the University of Texas at Austin, global population will reach 9 to 10 billion, possibly in the 2080s, but perhaps as early as the 2060s. From there, numbers, he says, will start falling with no end in sight. His new book that he's co-written is called After the Spike, Population Progress and the Case for People. Dean Spears joins us now to help us decipher what's going on. Dean Spears, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Okay, Dean, I have to say your premise is really confusing because you'll hear so many people talking about the population explosion, and it seems like, at least in our little area, the population is exploding and there's no end in sight. We're told that we should only have two kids, you know, to replace ourselves. And even in the case of China, who instituted the one child per family law that I think has now gone by the wayside. But what's going on? Did we overcorrect?
Zero population growth, or a future where the population stabilizes, and for every two adults in one generation, there are two children in the next generation, is a future that might be possible someday, but it's not the path that the world is on. The path that the world is on is a path towards global depopulation. That's the most likely future, and that means that every decade, every generation, the world's population would shrink. In a few decades, the world's population will begin to decline, and there's no reason to think that once that happens, it'll automatically reverse. And the reason is, as you said, the birth rate. If the world's average birth rate were an average of two children per two adult, then that would stabilize the population. But two-thirds of countries now are already below that two for two ratio, and it's been falling for not just decades, but centuries, and is projected to continue to decline. So the most likely future is that as the world's average birth rate falls, we'll briefly hit that two for two level, and the birth rate will just keep falling. And eventually, a few years or decades after that, we'll reach the year when the number of deaths is greater than the number of births, and that will be the year when the world starts to depopulate.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dean Spears. He's an economic demographer, and he is the author of After the Spike, Population Progress and the Case for People. We're talking about the science of depopulation. You say that depopulation is nothing new, but it seems like we've had a growing population until, as you say, quite recently. How does birth rate affect population? It seems like a really easy correlation, but I think you'll tell me it's not.
Well, it's actually nothing new having low or falling birth rates. All along, while the size of the population has been growing, the birth rate has been falling. So then why has the population been growing, right? It was flat for many thousands of years. And then a couple hundred years ago, or a few hundred years ago, our numbers first reached 1 billion in 1800. They doubled in the century after that. They quadrupled in the century after that to today's 8 billion. But why? It's not because people were suddenly having more babies. It's because humanity got better at keeping the children that we do have alive. We learned things like the germ theory of disease. We learned things like sanitation. Nutrition got better. And so more of us survived instead of dying. And that's why the population grew. But all along, for as long as we have records, birth rates have been falling from around 6 for the world as a whole in 1800 to 5.5 in 1900 to 5 in 1950 and less than half of that now. So we shouldn't think that just because the population has been growing, low and falling birth rates are something new.
Is the population and or birth rate still growing in some areas?
Well, even where birth rates are higher than two, they're still falling. The major world region where birth rates are still higher than two is sub-Saharan Africa. But there, even there, they've been falling from, you know, close to seven in 1950 through five in 2014 and now 4.3. And what's important about Africa is that female education and literacy there is still relatively low, not so different from what it would have been in India a few decades ago. And so the demographers at the UN and other population science groups project that birth rates in Africa are going to continue to fall like they have been in Africa and like they have been in other places, because there's so much room left for improving socioeconomic development, improving female literacy. And so when we see better education in Africa, we're probably going to see falling birth rates there too. Now, that said, that's going to unfold over coming decades. And so one of the things that's going to happen as the world moves towards a population peak and then decline is that the sort of average composition of the world is going to be reweighted in different places. Right now, there are about 1.2 billion people living in sub-Saharan Africa. It'll probably increase to around 3 billion by the end of the 21st century. But even so, as a whole, the world is going to peak and begin to decline. And of course, once Africa's birth rate is below two, then it too will be on the path to depopulation.
What about all the environmental damage that has come from population? It seems harm to the environment would be a reason for depopulation being positive.
I think the big reason why not is timing. But first, we should say, yes, we have big environmental challenges. And yes, people cause them. Human activity causes greenhouse gas emissions and has other destructive consequences. And if all of these humans had been on a different path for the past decades or centuries, then we might not be facing the challenge that we face now. The question now is, it's natural to think that the way to protect the environment is to have fewer humans, but is that right for the challenges we face today? You know, remember, depopulation is projected by the UN to start in 2080, right? That's six decades from now. And if you think of a child born today, she or he might be deciding whether or not to have kids 30 years from now or, say, 20 years from now. But, I mean, 30 years from now, that puts us on the far side of some pretty important climate milestones by which we need to be decarbonizing. And so my point is that the population is a big ship, slow to turn. And we shouldn't think that depopulation coming decades from now, or really anything that could change the most likely trajectory of the population, is going to happen in time for our environmental challenges. Let's consider the history of how we've made progress against our environmental challenges before. I mean, one story that stands out to me is particulate air pollution in China. You know, thinking back to the terrible peak in 2013 when, you know, media around the world called it China's airpocalypse, and, you know, particle pollution in the air, which is really terrible for health, for children's health, for older adults' mortality, was fairly literally off the scales. And so air pollution was terrible in China in 2013. What happened in the decade after that? Well, one thing that happened is that the population of China grew by 50 million people. That's an addition larger than the entire population of Canada or Argentina. And so if more people always makes environmental challenges worse, we might expect air pollution in China to have gotten worse. But in fact, particulate air pollution in China declined by half. And that was because leaders in the public there decided that the smog was unacceptable and implemented new regulations and requirements, closed down coal plants, and put rules on the ones that remained, improved the technologies. And it's not just China. Over the past decade, global average exposure to particulate pollution has fallen and the world's population has grown. Every time we've made environmental progress against our challenges, it's been by changing what people do. When I was a kid, I remember the challenge was the hole in the ozone layer from chlorofluorocarbons. And, you know, my kids don't add to the stock of CFCs in the atmosphere because we don't use CFCs in consumer products like that anymore because of the Montreal Protocol in the 1980s. Every time we've made progress against humans' destructive activity on the environment before, it hasn't been by reducing the number of humans, it's been by changing our destructive activities. So for example, when I was a kid, I remember the challenge was the hole in the ozone layer. But my children today don't worsen the hole in the ozone layer because they don't use chlorofluorocarbons. The Montreal Protocol effectively banned those. In the 70s, the challenge was leaded gasoline, and that changed. In the 90s, acid rain, which was regulating sulfur dioxide through the Clean Air Act. We have made progress against environmental challenges before, even as the population has been growing, and it's in by implementing new technologies, changing the regulation, caring about what happens, and changing what humans do. And so we do urgently need to continue making progress towards decarbonization, and that's going to be by decarbonizing the activity of the people who, frankly, we're going to have either way for the coming decades, and not hoping that depopulation, which could start decades from now, is going to be what gets us off the hook.
So, you know, going back to this idea, Dean, of an interconnected population and that we need to, part of innovation depends on our interconnectedness and therefore our population, I guess that's not coming really clear for me. Can you explain that with a little bit more detail, why that is a big premise of what you're talking about?
So this isn't an idea that's new to us. This is known in economics as the theory of endogenous growth. And it's what won Paul Romer a Nobel Prize in 2018 for understanding these two pieces of the puzzle. One is that the main way that we have better lives today, we have antibiotics and pain relievers and glasses and computer jobs and climate-controlled environments. It's the same sun shining on the planet, the same wind, the same rocks beneath us, but we know more and better what to do with them than people did before. And the reason that we know more what to do with them than people did 200 years ago is because we've had people between us that have discovered it and learned it. And that's a special economic resource, those ideas and those creativity that can be used and reused without being depleted. I don't want to give the impression that I just mean, you know, fancy high tech like smartphones in rich countries. Anytime people are doing something useful where they can learn by doing, it could happen. So if a nurse in a developing country is trying to help a mom breastfeed her underweight baby with lactation consulting, and then along the way she figures out that it would be safer and better to sew a particular type of wrap that could tie the baby onto the mom's chest and maybe prop them up with a rolled up towel, they've learned something. And that can be written down and take, you know, the old practice of lactation consulting, turn it into something new called kangaroo mother care, and the World Health Organization can send guidelines around the world that help other people in other places use this technology. And that's a new resource for people to build on. If we don't have other people, then we're not going to make progress as fast in solving the problems and improving the lives that we still need to solve and improve. We're used to thinking of other people as our competition, that other people are using up things that we want. But we should remember that other people are part of what makes what we want and need available in the first place, because they want and need it too.
Okay. Well, we don't have a lot of time left, and I wanted to ask you about some of these low birth rate countries, specifically, I think because we heard so much about when China had instituted the, you know, one child limit and all of the kind of resulting horror stories that came around that. You know, what have they found? You call them to a certain degree a canary in the coal mine. And what have they done to reverse this, the results of only having one child?
Yeah, I think a lot of what matters about population and the benefits we get from other people happen at the global level. So it's not one country or another. You know, we can learn things from people in another country. We can share things with people in another country. So it's not one country. I think we're not going to see some of the most important consequences of depopulation from one country or another, in part because for the time being, there's migration. But if the question is, what can governments or country governments do to raise birth rates? The answer is much less than you might think, based on what anybody now knows. There have been 26 countries where the lifetime average birth rate has fallen below 1.9, and in none of them has it ever gone back up to 2, even in countries that would say that they have programs and policies to promote higher birth rates. There are a lot of headwinds against parenting, and parenting has been unfair for a long time. We've heaped a lot of the burdens onto only parents, and especially only mothers and women for generations, and it could take a long time to undo that. And it's not a surprise that when parenting is so unfair and receives so little support from society that a lot of people look at their options and think that it's not what's going to fit in for them. So I want to be clear that we're not saying that, you know, if somebody chooses, I want to be clear that if somebody chooses to have no children or few children, it's not for anyone else to say whether they're making a mistake. But because depopulation is coming, all of us together should consider whether society is making a mistake when we make it hard for people to choose larger families or to have children. We should consider, given that we're not on the path to overpopulation, that depopulation is the most likely future, is that something that we want to welcome by default, or should we be bringing more people into a conversation about what we want? In our book, we're making the case that a stabilized future population, not growing unendingly generation after generation, but a stabilized future, exactly that zero population growth that we started with, would be better than global depopulation. We also think that a stabilized population is compatible with commitments to environmental stewardship, reproductive freedom, and continued progress against global poverty. We want other people that think so to be a part of this conversation.
So, Dr. Spears, what do you hope that, say, policymakers take away from the book after the spike? What's the big lesson there for them?
I think that it would be too early to jump in to writing a piece of legislation or trying to craft some government program because depopulation is the most likely future a few decades from now. I think right now, a lot of people still believe that overpopulation is the most likely future. And even if they know that depopulation is likely, they might not have considered whether it's a future to welcome. And so the place to start is to have this conversation about the facts, about what's likely, and about the case for people and why depopulation might not be the future to choose. Just like over the past several decades, we've learned so much more than we used to know about climate change, and we're in a much better position now to be making climate policy because of all of the science and social movements that have happened over the decades since people first understood some big picture facts about burning fossil fuels. We're in a similar position now that we know some big picture facts that if the world's birth rate goes below 2 and stays there, depopulation would be what happens, and that that's likely. But we don't know all of the details that we might someday know about how to construct a future where we do a better job supporting parents, sharing the burdens of parenting, and making it so that people feel like they can choose to incorporate parenting alongside the other things that would make a good life for them. So that's why we should start having the conversation now, so that decades down the line, just like has happened with climate change, we know better about what to do then.
Yeah, this is a point that I wanted to sort of wrap up with, is the point you make in the book about how children are everyone's responsibility. It's not only women's, and it's not only, you know, both parents as well, that we, you know, the concept of it takes a village is what you think we need to, you know, live by. And so this means, I mean, so many people I know now, they don't have a second child or a third child because they can't afford to, even if, you know, there are two working professionals. It's expensive, maybe more
so. And it's more than money. It's time and effort and attention and so many things.
Yeah. So how can we better do that? Because you say that traditional policies like tax incentives or subsidies for, you know, having children don't really work. So what do you suggest?
That's right. And I think we shouldn't be surprised that a few thousand dollars of child tax credit is not what's going to move the needle. I mean, after all, how many of us would marry somebody different for a tax credit of $3,000? I've been asking that question and nobody has said yes yet, because when we're making the decisions to form our families and write our own life stories, these are big decisions, much bigger than the sort of government policy as usual that folks have talked about. But right now, we have a culture that says that there's care work and there's important work. And these are two different things and they're done by different people. And perhaps if we had recognized that care work is important work and that we all have a role to play in contributing to the next generation because we all have an interest in the future, perhaps if more of us had seen that all along, then we wouldn't be facing the same sort of headwinds against parenting and challenges that we're facing now. So the culture and the structures that we've developed that build so many headwinds against parenting and make it unfair, those have been built over a long time. And it's not going to be something that we're going to undo quickly. But we wouldn't have written this book if we weren't optimistic that a different future were possible. And the reason that we think that a different future is possible is that nobody is born with all of the beliefs that they're going to have someday about children and parenting and gender roles and society. That if we get working on building a future where parenting is more fair, not just with dads doing more, although that's a place to start, but also more support from the rest of society, then, you know, the next generation is going to grow up seeing that being what parenting looks like for them to see. And their children are going to grow up seeing a parenting that's a little bit easier and a little bit fairer. And so then maybe a couple generations down the line, if people see an example where people are able to choose parenting and combine it with the other things that are valuable to them, maybe that's work, maybe that's education, maybe that's just friends and leisure and taking a nap, whatever it is people want, if we work towards a society where people do have that option, then people will grow up and maybe be more excited, enthusiastic, and optimistic that they can aspire to having the families they want.
Really interesting. The book is After the Spike, Population Progress and the Case for People. Our guest is economic demographer Dean Spears. Dean, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KBCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, San Francisco Design and IT Innovated. Stay tuned. Coming up next is National Public Radio News from Washington, right after this.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A federal judge in New Hampshire says he will certify a class action lawsuit challenging President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. He ruled the order may not go into effect for 7 days to allow the government to appeal. U.S. District Judge Joseph LaPlante said issuing the injunction was not a close call, that Trump's order would cause irreparable harm if allowed to go into effect. He said citizenship is the greatest privilege that exists in the world. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he met with Russian Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov, and they discussed what he called a new and different approach for ending the war in Ukraine. He did not elaborate. Rubio said he wouldn't characterize it as something that guarantees a peace, but says it's a concept he'll take back to the president. The two men met in Malaysia on the sidelines of an annual summit. Rubio also says he's hopeful about a ceasefire in Gaza soon. His statement echoes President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Obstacles remain as negotiators try to navigate final sticking points. Meanwhile, rescuers pulled four more survivors from the Red Sea after a Greek ship was sunk this week by Yemen's Houthi rebels. NPR's Ruth Sherlock has the latest.
The Houthi rebel group attacked the Eternity Sea bulk carrier vessel as part of a campaign to target any ships from companies that they believe could have had dealings with Israel. Houthi rebels say these attacks are a response to Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza. There were 25 people known to have been on board. Most are Filipino. A number are still missing, and in a statement claiming responsibility for the attack, a Houthi spokesman said the group had, quote, rescued a number of the crew. The U.S. Embassy in Yemen has accused the Houthis of kidnapping the seafarers. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News.
Hundreds of mourners gathered last night in Kerr County, Texas, to remember those who died from last week's catastrophic floods. The Texas Newsroom's Lucio Vanquez reports from the Texas Hill Country, where at least 120 people died and more than 160 are missing.
Bleachers filled with grieving neighbors, all praying and singing together, remembering the victims. The vigil also included a tribute to Camp Mystic, which became the heart of one of the deadliest natural disasters in Texas history. Randy Rose, who grew up in the area, says the vigil gave the community a moment to breathe.
It was a time of healing. It was a time of trying to, you know, get back to some normalcy and step away from the tragedy for a minute.
Rose says he felt lighter after leaving the vigil. Still, the community is bracing for long days ahead. For NPR News, I'm Lucio Vasquez in Kerrville.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 211 points. This is NPR News. The Brennan Center for Justice, which has been critical of President Trump, surveyed election officials across the country and found more than 60% of them are concerned about Trump administration cuts to the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency that provides services designed to protect the integrity of elections. Almost 90% say state and local governments will have to make up the difference. Local officials also worry about political leaders interfering with their jobs, as well as false information in elections on the internet. Secretary of Health Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has postponed a meeting of a federal task force that makes health recommendations. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force was set to gather today. NPR's Will Stone has more.
The group of independent experts conducts in-depth reviews of medical research and crafts federal guidance on preventive care, like cancer screenings or who should take what medications. A spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services confirmed the meeting was canceled, but did not provide any details about why. The decision to call off the meeting is worrying some public health groups, given the recent changes to another federal task force that deals with vaccines. Recommendations that come from the committee can have broad influence, shaping insurance coverage and health policy. Will Stone, NPR News.
Today is Mu Dang's first birthday. She's the baby pygmy hippo in Thailand that became an internet star. Thousands of people came to her zoo south of Bangkok to help her celebrate. The 4 days of festivities include a charity auction, a parade, and free admission for children under the age of 12. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com.